Accession number 28661, Mr. A. Crisford, Reel 3. Now, we're talking about this process of your training, your dual instruction on the steerman. So how do they progress the training? Obviously, you're going at your own pace. You're not being forced, or are you being forced?
Yes, because... And I can't remember exactly after however many hours it was flying when you had to solo. But if I remember rightly, it was something like 9 or 10 hours flying instruction. But that's only a rough guess. I'm not sure that's accurate. And obviously,
so there was a limited amount of dual instruction you got before
you did solo.
And what would happen if you weren't ready after this 12 or whatever hours it was?
Well, then you would have been subjected to a test by not your instructor, but by somebody else. And if he didn't think you were suitable, and this happened to quite a lot of them, you were taken off the course, not suitable as a pilot. And you had to remuster as a navigator, air gunner, wireless operator, whatever.
Now, I presume after you've learned these turns and things, before you could do a solo, you have to learn to take off and land.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Now, starting with the takeoff is logical. What did you have to watch when you were taking off? What's the art of taking off?
Well, in America, bearing in mind we were flying in a civilian airfield, we had to fly what they called a pattern, and you took off. Obviously, your tail is on the ground, you accelerate up, and you ease almost automatically the tail came up so that you could then see. And when you got to whatever it was, speed, you eased the stick back and took off. You then had to fly straight ahead, and I can't remember the height now, but I think it was something like, say, 300 feet, where you had to do a 45-degree turn to the left, and then you left what they call the pattern, and then you could fly off.
Now, did they teach you at this stage the old First World War lesson that you never turn immediately after taking off, otherwise
you had to get to a certain height, and I can't remember what it was now.
So you were made aware that you didn't turn back to the airfield in the early.
No.
So that was a takeoff.
As far as landing was concerned,
was the takeoff relatively easy?
Yes, I think if I got a Tiger Moth today, I could take it off. I kid myself.
So it was fairly intuitive.
Yes.
Now, what about landing? Because I understand landing is not necessarily quite so easy.
No, you've got to know what you're doing. You had to join, I can remember this, you had to join downwind at 45 degrees to the downwind leg at 500 feet. And then when you'd gone downwind, you turned 90 degrees to the left or right, or left actually, because you always had to join the pattern on the left-hand side, as it were. You turn 90 degrees to the landing point, and at a given turn, when you thought it was right, you had to cut the throttle, turn in, and glide in and land without touching the throttle at all. And if you did, as I said earlier, you had to take off and go around again. So it did teach you, and it was quite easy. If there's no wind blowing, you could sort of begin to get the idea, the feel of the thing, and it was okay. But if there was a high wind blowing, of course, you had to cut the engine a lot later because you slowed down quite quickly.
Was judgment difficult? I mean, because people have had problems with landing too fast, landing too slow, landing too high.
Yeah, stalling.
It's this business of landing before, you know, in high up, 20, 30 feet up, and sort of flattening and pancaking from there.
Yes,
were any of these problems for you? Or?
I remember doing one and did what they call a ground loop, which...
Tell me what a ground loop is.
Well, it's when you're coming in to land and you perhaps have come in and landed possibly a bit too fast and you haven't really properly stalled, and you've got to realise that with the engine cut, you've got virtually very little control over the aircraft other than the rudder keeping it straight. Well, if you go off the straight, the outside wing tends to drop, and when it hits the ground, it then pulls the aircraft round on that wing, and that's what they call a ground loop. It doesn't do the structure of the aircraft much good.
So it sort of spins round? And
yeah, on the ground. I think practically everybody that's in those days, you weren't worth your salt unless you've done at least one ground loop.
Would the instructors interfere if you were doing something like landing 50 feet?
Well, they would be watching you.
So if you started to stall at too high an altitude or too fast, or would they? I mean, stalling, you can't stall when you're too fast. But, you know, I mean, if you're starting to land too fast or you're landing too slow and you're going to stall before you're at the right, well, would they intervene? Or
well, if the instructor was with you, yes, obviously. But when you went off on your solo trips, I mean, there was nobody there to help you.
I'll come back. I'm in with the instructions.
Well, when the instructors...
Would they talk to you through the gospel, through the speaking tube?
Yeah, and quite naturally, if you were doing something darn stupid, they would shout like mad.
Now, anything else you learned on dual before you went solo?
Yes, aerobatics, I think, from memory.
You started aerobatics before you went solo?
Yes, because they had to teach you. I mean, you had even after you'd soloed, you still had your instructor come with you to teach you all sorts of things, like how to do a stall turn, loop the loop, slow roll, all sorts of things.
Now, how do you do all those things? Do you remember them now? I mean, I know you haven't flown since 43, but I mean... Stall turns, loops.
Well, a stall turn is cutting the engine and sticking your nose up in the air until it stalls, and then you flick the rudder to turn it over one way or t'other, and you'd go into a spin, and then you would ease the stick forward, open your throttle, and you'd come out of the spin, and you'd carry on flying
in a different direction.
Oh yeah,
presume, you know, the direction you wanted.
Yeah,
that sounds quite difficult.
Well, on a Stearman it was dead easy, actually, because I mean the aircraft were such beautiful things to fly. They really were.
So that's a loop you mentioned.
Yeah,
how do you do a loop?
Well, obviously you had to have sufficient ground height to do it. And I can't really remember in a Stearman how high you should be, minimum. But you would rev up and go downhill so that you were going a little bit faster, and you pull the stick up, and you'd go up and up and up and up, and then when you're literally upside down, you lose the feel of things. And as you come down to the side, you gradually hold... realise that the controls are having some effect, and obviously you don't leave the stick back in your stomach, because otherwise you would virtually go up a second roll or whatever, a second loop, and so you ease the stick forward, and you would throttle back, and you'd assume normal flying.
That easy enough?
Slow roll is not difficult. Not really.
So hang on, slow roll or the loop? Hang on.
Sorry.
The loop's the not loop's difficult. Not. I thought that's what you meant, yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Now, the slow roll, though, you did mention. No,
you've got to know... You've got to be quite experienced to do a good slow roll.
Why is it so difficult? Well,
you've got to remember that you... A slow roll is quite quick, if you know what I mean, when you fly. It's meant to be a slow... because when you turn over, you've got... your nose would drop, and you've got to give as you go over. For instance, if you're going to do a slow roll this way, your nose would drop, and you've got to give opposite rudder as you go over to keep your nose up. And then you're upside down, where the controls obviously work opposite. And as you come back, I don't think I ever did what I would call a perfect slow roll ever. And not many people do, because the nose would, you'd start off flying that way and you'd do a slow roll and you'd be ending up flying in this direction.
So to the right, you'd veer to the right instead of...
If you were rolling this way,
Any other aerobatics you recall? Because this is quite valuable for us.
Not really, no.
That's a good start. So you'd learn this first. Now, with your instructor. Now, how would the instructor assess you as being ready for solo? Were you aware of when you were ready, or would he tell you, or was it a surprise to you?
I don't think he ever told anybody, not our chap. I mean, he would go out one day and you'd do perhaps a couple of takeoff and a couple of landings. And if I remember rightly, then he undid his straps, got out, and he said, right, off you go. Remember what I've told you?
Now, tell me about your first solo. What's it feel like?
Very exciting, because I can remember, and I think most people feel the same way, when you've taken off, which is quite easy, and you're up there, and you think, God almighty, I've got to get this bloody thing down again. I don't say panic sets in, but I think training does tend to make you do what you're supposed to do automatically. Because I can remember when I was shot down, I can remember afterwards thinking, Carl, I did what I should to do. You know, it's one of those things that with training, if you've really got anything inside here, you do as you're told automatically, as
so
it were.
On your first solo, you just went... Now, what routine, what were you meant to do on a first solo? Or was it just get up and get down again?
Yeah, it was just sort of a circuit and a bump. I mean, you left the pattern and joined it again and came in. Because he wanted... your instructor wanted to see you come back in one bit.
And any events... anything happen of note in your first solo?
Not that I recall.
So a reasonable landing, then?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I see. Do you remember the date of your first solo?
No, is the answer to that. I can't remember it.
Now, how did your training progress then? So you've done your first solo, and from then on, would it be lectures in the morning and then or afternoon, and then a mixture of solo and dual flights?
Yeah.
Now, what were you learning? What was the sort of syllabus then? How did they develop your flying? Because you were now a pilot of sorts. How did they make you into a good pilot?
Well, I think when we were on Stearman's, I don't think we did very much other than that. It was when we went on to another airfield to what they called... and flew a BT-13, if I remember
rightly. Is that still while you're at Dar Aero?
No. Went to another airfield.
Now, hang on. So anything else happened at Dar Aero? Well, you know, any other training you got there? Or
no. Other than the fact that the first part of your training, you were a lower classman, and then when you, the second half, when the senior lot had moved out, we then moved over from the barracks that we were in to the other side, where I shared a room with one chap. There was just two of us in a room.
And what were the conditions of service like there?
Oh, very good.
In what way? What was so good about
well,
it?
Well, I mean, the discipline was pretty hot. But the general conditions, I mean, you had sheets and a proper bed. You had to keep the place tidy, but providing you did and do as you're told, there was no problems.
And the food?
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Was it American or British style? I was presuming it would be
American. American.
Was that unusual to your palate then? I mean, because it was not like now, is it? Where we're all used to these things. Was it unusual to you at the time?
Not that I recall. I seem to remember the most times that you got meat, it was chicken. And for dessert, you always had ice cream. But apart from that, I can't think there was anything unusual.
And plenty of it.
Oh, yeah, as much as you wanted. Yeah.
Now, how did you get on with the Americans? I mean, I don't know whether there are any Americans about. I mean...
Well, funnily enough...
Other than the instructors, I mean...
I was pretty pally with two chaps when we were at Dar Aerotech. And...
Americans?
No.
Sorry, chaps.
British.
British
boys. Lynn Coughlin and Peter Cope.
Why them two? What was... Well, tell us a bit about them. Why them? What were they like?
I suppose we just sort of palled up.
What would you do together? I mean, were you drinking that? Did you drink then? Or
No. When we had time off, we used to catch the bus that went into Albany, which was only about, 10 minutes away. And we used to go into a Chinese restaurant, I remember, and then go to the cinema. Of course, we had to be back in barracks by, I think it was 10 o'clock. But that's about all we did do. But early on, we were met by a lady by the name of Mrs. Hallam, who lived in Thomasville, which is about 50 miles away, dead straight. And she came along one day and said, I'd like to come home for supper. And we thought she lived just up the road, but not a bit of it. It was sort of 50 miles away or whatever it was. It was quite a long way. Took about an hour, I suppose, flat out. And Mrs. Hallam had two daughters. One was slightly older than us, because we were all 18, 19-year-olds. And I suppose one of them was about 21, 22, and one was a bit younger than us. And the three of us got quite pally with the Hallam family. They were very nice, and we regularly went up there for a meal. And the two girls were charming. Don't ask me what they did or anything, but I know the younger one married an English lad on another course later on, and she came over to England.
Now, while you were there, the Americans would come into the war, wouldn't they? December 41.
Yes.
Do you remember? Because it'd be Pearl Harbor, wouldn't it? Yeah. I've forgotten the date, 7th of December or something.
Very distinctly, I can remember it.
What happened that day? I mean,
well, I was at Dar Aerotech. It was a Sunday, and we all had to go to the high school where there was a American football match between Albany High School and whoever it was. And during the interval, we were going to give, and did give, an exhibition of English rugby. And all the Americans thought we were completely, utterly balmy. Because there we were in a pair of shorts and a singlet. And of course, when they were playing football, they had helmets, shoulder guards, chest guards, knee pads, thigh pads, you name it. And they thought we were completely bonkers. And in the middle of all this, there was a tannoy message. All British cadets must report back to Dar Aerotech immediately. And we thought, hello, what the heck's this going on? And they repeated it. So like good lads, we reported back. And the idea was, because it was Pearl Harbor, and of course, being Americans, all the aircraft were in one row, the propellers all pointing in the same direction. And we had to go back, ostensibly, to disperse the aircraft. And we, in our wisdom, said, why are we dispersing the aircraft? Well, in case there's an air raid from Japan. And I can remember us saying, where are they refueling? Because Japan's, 9,000 miles away from Georgia. It must be more than that. So no aircraft could have reached there, but they panic stations. And from then on, of course, we weren't allowed out in our civvies. We had to wear uniforms.
And what news did you get at Pearl Harbor? I mean, did the news spread quickly?
Oh, yes, yeah, so that virtually we were told, I think, you know, the American Navy has been wiped out virtually. Lots of damage, lots of deaths. And there was, I can remember the civilians in Albany when we first went in our uniforms wondered who the heck we were, because they had no idea that the RAF were there. I mean, we were just English civilians learning to fly, as far as they were concerned, until Pearl Harbor.
Well, were you pleased the Americans were in the war? I'm sure you weren't pleased that they'd been attacked at Pearl Harbor. Were you pleased they were, that you know, the
I think it was more relief, wasn't it? I'm not sure we had...
You didn't think about it much.
Well, in a way, I'm testing my memory, but I think we were relieved that they were, like us then, fighting the enemy. But I do know that the similar thing happened in 9/11. I had a grandson who was in San Francisco, and he was saying the Americans panicked like mad.
Now, what about, were there, one thing about flying schools is accidents, you know, that which are quite common sometimes. Were there any accidents while you were there, either to you or to other people, or any fatalities in the course?
Well, if there were, I don't remember them. There were some near misses.
Any involving you, or that you remember?
Good heavens, no. No, I don't think, I don't remember any. No, I don't think so.
Okay, so you were there at Dar Aerotech till Albany, till May?
No.
Ah, so that was changed, was it?
No, that was the initial training on Stearman's. We then went to, I think it was called Craigfield Selma in Alabama.
So Craigfield, spelt as it sounds?
Yes, Craig. Field in Selma.
Selma.
Yeah. And there we flew...
Now, when did you go there, roughly speaking? Would that be... Well, obviously after December.
Well, it's certainly after December the 6th or 7th, whatever it was. Yeah, we were there at Christmas time, I remember.
So you'd moved in December?
Yeah.
And what were you flying? Was this a different unit, or did it have a name, or was it just
training? Intermediate training on BT-13s, which was a single-seater, twin-seater monoplane. BT-13, I think it was called. I've got a picture of it somewhere.
Now, what was that aircraft like? I've not heard of that one at all. I've heard of the Stearman, but what's a BT-13?
Well,
what's the characteristics?
It was, you know what a Harvard looks like?
Give them an idea, because it's for them, not me, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Well, it was a single-wing, single-engined, dual cockpit. But they were covered. They had I was going to say lid. What am I trying to say? But not an open cockpit. And then our flying instructors were American Army Air Corps. Yeah. And it was obviously a very much faster aircraft.
What speed? I mean, would it be so slower than a Hurricane or something like that?
Oh, Lord, yes. Yeah. I'd only be guessing.
Right, they can look it up.
Quite honestly. Look it up.
Now, how did you... I mean, well, what happened when you got to Craigfield? What sort of accommodation were you put in there?
Well, there, it was more like... if I remember rightly, they were in rooms of about 6 or 7 or 8 or thereabouts. They were more like army barracks, but there was no complaints about I mean, it was all very good and high standard, and the food again still was wonderful. But of course, then we every time we went to the mess hall, we marched behind a bugler and a drummer and a chap holding the Union Jack, the Stars and Stripes, and you marched into the mess hall because we were then sort of much more military than the easygoing life that we'd had at our Dare Our Road Tech.
Now, take me through the training on the BT-13 then. What was it like to fly? What sort of training were you doing there? Because this is where they move you on at stage, isn't it?
Yes, well, it was a more powerful aircraft. Don't ask me what engine it had got, I can't remember. But it was a more powerful, faster, and you had a different landing speed. And then, of course, too, you had to learn to fly at night.
Now, tell me about that.
First of all, you did in the daytime, you had to do instrument flying, where they had a canopy that came over your head. So although it was daytime and you got the instructor with you, you were flying by instruments.
How did you find that? Was that something you could...
I didn't find it easy to begin with, but you gradually got used to it, of course. I know the concentration needed was... there were more instruments don't ask me what they were, but there were more instruments, I remember. And you'd got to make sure you were looking at them all to make sure you didn't go upside down or something stupid.
And night flying, what was that like?
Well, then, of course, you went off with your instructor at night. And bearing in mind that they still had lights and like landing at night in England now, where you've got the runway lit up and everything else. So it wasn't as difficult as you'd assume. But of course, when you'd taken off and disappeared into the wild blue yonder, you had to fly on instruments. Because on a dark night, there's nothing you can see outside to help you, except the stars, if you're lucky.
Now, were you doing any formation flying by now? You know, practicing formations?
Do you know, I can't... We did certainly when we were on the advanced course with Harvard's.
Well, let's leave it to the Harvard. What about anything learning sort of the sort of techniques you'd need for actual fighting, you know, fighter tactics and things like that? Or were you this very much still learning to fly rather than flinging the airplane?
Yes.
So what, instrument and night flying, what else were you doing? Cross-country runs?
Yes, elementary ones.
Now, what was a cross-country run like? I presume it was harder in a place like America than, for instance, in England.
Well, everything is so wide apart over there, of course. Distances mean nothing over there. But I think...
So,
from memory, they used to take off and land... The instructor or somebody or other would be landing at point A... And then another one, say, at point B, so you had to fly a triangle to get back to base. And as you flew over wherever this aircraft was, you had to come down very low so they could read the number of your aircraft, so they knew that Crisford, for instance, had gone from A to B back to base. All quite elementary.
Now, how did your navigation stand up to this?
Well... It was quite easy, really, because bearing in mind America, vast open spaces, and I suppose point A would have only been, I don't know, I can't remember, say 30 miles away, just for argument's sake. So it was quite a short sort of distance all round, and you knew very well that it was near to a road or whatever. And as soon as you saw that aircraft in the distance, you knew, well, that's it. And you go down very low and say, hello, and off you go to point B.
So not too much trouble doing it.
No, not really.
Any other type of special flight? In the intermediate train, any other sort of thing you were learning? I presume the lectures were still going on.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And exams. Or tests, rather than exams, I suppose. But, of course, there were quite a number of people that were being gradually weeded out.
So there's continued that, did there? I mean, yeah. It wasn't just the first batch.
No. If I remember rightly, going back to Stearman's, if you hadn't soloed after 15 hours duel, you automatically came off and had to remuster as something else. But you were expected, I think I said, 9-10 hours or thereabouts.
You think it's 15 now?
The 15 was the deadline. If you hadn't soloed by 15, I'm pretty sure that was it. Out. Because a mate of mine, I can remember who had... In fact, the chap that I was talking about, 3rd of September, he failed as a pilot, and he remustered as a navigator. And went on to great things, DFC and Bar, and stayed on in the RAF after the war. Because if he'd been a pilot, no doubt he wouldn't be here now. Because there aren't many of us left.